speaking on this program is Brother Gary Cawley.
We want to remind you from week to week that the gospel of Christ is God's power to change your life. And it will bring your change in life by forgiveness, in your meeting of the conditions of forgiveness, and it will bring the saving power of the gospel to you and thereby bring to you a new life under a new master. Jesus Christ is to be the head over all. Who will come into the church? Ephesians 1:22-23, He gave Him to be the head over all things to the church, which is His body, the fullness of Him that filleth all in all. And of course we learn that Jesus has all authority in heaven and upon earth, Matthew 28:18. Since this is the case then, would you not put yourself under His mastership, walk in His teaching, live by His law of life, and the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus is able to make you free from the law of sin and death. We do hope that that will be your aim and your desire, and especially that you will come and be with us in our services at the Southwest Church of Christ today. The New Testament, of course, is the revealed Christ and the plan of salvation. But the Old Testament, according to Romans 15:4, is there for our learning and for our admonition. And one of the compelling evidences for inspiration of the Bible is the impartial manner in which the lives of Bible characters are portrayed. At least by Bible characters, I mean those that are recorded in the Bible. Indeed, the weaknesses as well as the mistakes of its heroes, as well as its villains, are uncompromisingly revealed in the book divine. Now, when a man begins to write a biography of another, he usually leaves out the bad parts. He leaves out those parts that he thinks might cast a bad light upon him, but not true with the Bible. This is God's book, not man's book. And this point is dramatically illustrated, I believe, in the life of David, Israel's greatest king. Israel, of course, desired a king that they might be like other nations, and God granted it. Although Samuel was told, "It's not against you, Samuel, it's against me that they desire a king, that they might be like other nations round about them, and that I should not rule over them." David, however, was indeed a friend of God, one who desired to please God, and yet David found indeed that when sin entered into his life, there was a very high cost to it. You know, in spite of the fact that David was a powerful statesman and a brilliant musician and poet, you know, he wrote many of the Psalms that are found in the book divine, and he was an exceptional religious leader who found favor, according to Acts 7:46, in the sight of God. But yet there were flaws in David's character. His darkest hour is detailed in 2 Samuel 12. The narrative that is therein given describes the king's lustful license with the beautiful Bathsheba. You recall that the adulterous union resulted in the conception of a child and led the king to arrange for the murder of the husband of that woman whom he called and had the child with. Well, severe judgments were leveled against the house of David for these transgressions. And one of these punishments was that the child, illegitimately conceived, was not to live. When the infant was finally born, David hoped to influence God to change his mind. The king prayed, as you'll recall, in 2 Samuel 12, and he fasted, but the baby lived only a week. And when the remorseful ruler learned of the child's death, he arose from the earth, he cleansed himself, and he went to worship in the house of Jehovah. His court thought it strange that his demeanor was so altered. And in a remarkable explanation, David exclaimed, "I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." 2 Samuel 12 and verse 23. This is absolutely true of all children who pass from this life early in life. We're not able to call them back, and we realize that life has to go on. It's not the easiest thing in the world, in fact, very, very difficult, to give up a babe in our arms. And yet, my friends, we realize that that babe is safe. That babe is not born totally depraved, as some want us to believe. That babe is safe in the arms of Jesus. And what a wonderful thing to know that if we meet the conditions of pardon, we too can be saved in the arms of Jesus. If we continue to walk in the light as He is in the light, then we have fellowship one with another. And even the blood of Jesus, His Son, cleanseth us from all sin. 1 John 1 and verse 7. And so when we need comfort and need strength in the loss of a child, we refer to the words of David, "I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. In this episode, though, that is given further in 2 Samuel 13, there is a way for a moment to consider another event that was later in the life of Israel's renowned king. And in this, it was the birth of another son. David had a lovely daughter named Tamar, and Tamar's half-brother Ammon was quite taken with his sister. He lusted for her, and when she would not yield, he raped her. In 2 Samuel 13 and verse 14, the account is given. And Tamar's full brother Absalom learned of the horrible deed which was done to his sister, and he was outraged. And doubtless he expected his father to avenge the wicked act. But David did nothing, perhaps due to his own weakness in these areas of fleshly desire. But you know, Absalom would not be denied justice. And so at the end of 2 years, seeing all the while he laid a plot, and he went about to kill Ammon. This is recorded in 2 Samuel 13 and verse 29. What a disgrace. What a heartache to the house of David. And yet these are the results, my friends, of a young man who doesn't listen to the right way of the Lord. Oftentimes, fathers are influenced over those children and cause them to fall into this sin. As a result of this assassination, Absalom was forced, as you know, to flee beyond the Jordan for asylum. And 3 years he was in exile. And it says in 2 Samuel 13 and verse 37, "And David mourned for his son every day." Finally, Absalom was allowed to return to Jerusalem, but even then, he was not permitted into his father's presence for 2 more years. 2 Samuel 14 and verse 28 records it. So from the outset of his return, the ungrateful lad began to make plans to tear from his father his own throne. And the kingdoms that were toppled overnight, and so the rebellion of this son was to stop his father from rule. And he stealthily stole the hearts of the men of Israel, says 2 Samuel 15 and verse 6. There's more than one kind of thief in the world, isn't there? It may be one who steals our character. It may be one even in our own family that desires to steal our good reputation. But this young son decided to rebel, and he stole the hearts of Israel from under the king. Well, when the time was right, Absalom, with a strong military force, declared himself to be the new king. And David fled from the capital city, weeping as he climbed the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem, according to 2 Samuel 15 and verse 30. You know, the wise commander soon gathered his wits together, though, and he made plans to put down the insurrection. And eventually the forces of David and those of Absalom would meet in mortal conflict in the forest of Ephraim east of the Jordan. Now the record reflects a tender note, though, in that the king specifically charged his captains in 2 Samuel 18:5, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom." But his command was to be ignored. And as Absalom rode through the dense forest, as you recall, the Bible records he caught his head or his hair in the boughs of a great oak tree, and his mule ran out from under beneath him. And Joab, David's commander, and some of the soldiers came upon the young man in that unfortunate situation, and Absalom was killed as he helplessly hung there. When David heard of the death of his beloved, though wretched, son, he uttered one of the most plaintive cries, I suppose, recorded in the Bible. 1 Samuel 18:33, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would that I had died for thee. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." How many times do we hear fathers in their great difficulties concerning their son's ill life, that they may make the same statements? Now, here is the intriguing question. Why was the deportment of David so important as he contemplated the deaths of his son? The infant, 1 Samuel 12, and Absalom, 2 Samuel 18. Well, in the case of the former, the young child, there was a sense of resignation and peace. In the latter, there was sheer agony. It seems clear that the difference lay in the fact that some issues are resolved in eternity, and that prospect loomed large in the mind of the king. The baby had passed into the care of Jehovah pure and safe. The ambitious Absalom had opposed God's anointed, and thus the Lord himself, and his prospects for the future were anything but bright. Little wonder that David cried out with such sorrow. What about our Absaloms today? You know, the great stories of the Old Testament are not meaningless myths of the past, but rather, as I noticed with you in the beginning, they are there for our learning and for our admonition. They're narratives about historical people and places and events, and they contain valuable lessons from which we can learn. Philosopher George Stadia, who is generally credited with the oft-quoted saying, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Well, among the many lessons to be learned from the life of David, the tragedy of losing a child to apostasy has to be one of the more heartbreaking. You know, it's been estimated that even among Christians, losing 80% of the youth from the church at times by the time they reach 21 years of age. Now, I don't know where those statistics come from, and I'm not too sure they're correct. But if it is right, 4 out of 5 are lost in some way to faithfulness to the Lord and His cause. Does that shock you? It should. I don't know, my friends, about the basis of such statistics, as I said, and I'm inclined to think that the estimate may be fairly accurate, though, in some ways, but in other places I'm sure that it's not. But I'm sure, too, that several of my close friends, whom I see in the Brotherhood, being involved in gospel meetings, traveling over the world in lectureships, it is true that they say this may be well within the bounds of right. It's a numbing fact that at the most of these events are, relatively speaking, few young people in attendance. And where are they? Many of them, tragically, are on their way to becoming Absaloms. That's such a sad thing, isn't it? They're steadily drifting away from the religious backgrounds they have been taught. And they are finding in the Bible that they should walk in the will of the Lord, and yet they even reject the Bible. And in a few years, they will be gone altogether if they continue in that course. Why? Well, there are numerous reasons, and several, of course, have addressed this matter in the recent years. But in my judgment, these are the least 3 contributing factors. The destruction, first of all, of personal faith. This is a contributing factor. From the time our youngsters start watching television, do you know they will perhaps see 21,000 hours by the time they're 18 years of age? Seeing that these programs are oftentimes geared to bring down people instead of up in their morals, we believe that it is not the best thing for their good. The school systems oftentimes propagandize with a variety of teachings that are designed to destroy their faith in God and their confidence in the Bible. What a shame. In 100 subtle ways, children are taught the theory of evolution, that it is scientifically credible, when it is not credible at all to anyone who knows the truth. But those who do not accept this view of origins are viewed as intellectually deprived. They're back numbers. They're old mossbacks. And if they do not believe evolution as a fact, at least to a significant degree, they're ridiculed and they're penalized. Studies have demonstrated that there is a direct relationship between the acceptance of evolutionary theory and the degree of one's educational indoctrination. Indeed, that causes many difficulties in a young person's life. And the public school system, to the significant degree, is weakening our youth. Thank God for Christian parents who have the determination to educate their children at home. This, of course, is something that needs to be done in every home, and they need to be sure they're in Bible classes every Lord's Day and every Wednesday evening and every opportunity that they have. This is a growing practice, and it ought to be applauded. Popular author Vance Packard once wrote, "The discoverers of astronomers, geologists, and space explorers have undermined the faith of all but the most devout that there is a physical heaven and hell." Can you believe it, my friends? Many people don't believe in heaven and hell anymore. And among believers, God is more likely to be seen as a force or a spirit than as an all-seeing watcher over human behavior above. Well, add to this the sobering reality that at home, and for the most part during church meetings, young people are given almost nothing to counter this insidious doctrine that is being prompted and put into their minds with a deadly formula. Are we providing our youngsters with sound materials to build strong faith? I hope and trust the home realizes its great responsibility here. Ephesians 6, verse 1 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment, with promise, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but nurture them or train them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Not only is there destruction in these personal teachings that are being received by our young people, but there's that encroachment of the world. You know, the times are changing. Yes, so drastically so, that is right. Youngsters these days are brutalized with the carnality of the world at increasingly tender years. More and more, the Lord's people are exposed to the dangers of drugs and alcohol in these waning days of the 20th century. Television, with its inundation of lustful explicitity, MTV, in the premium of TV channels, has broken down the barrier in many lives of sexual purity. And many of our young people are accustomed to ogling nudity in the movies and on television. They seem to think that's just an everyday thing, and not that which is condemned by the Lord. But once many of these teens have lost their innocence, tasted of the alluring pleasures of hedonism, of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die, it is well nigh impossible to bring them back to godliness. What a loss, what a shame. Would we say, O Absalom, Absalom, my son, Absalom? Then there is parental neglect, of course, contributing to this thought too. And one of the greatest contributors to the development of Absaloms in the kingdom of our Lord is that of parental neglect. Fathers and mothers are too busy. They have their work, they have their clubs. Many parents, even within the framework of church, are far more concerned with their children's academic achievements than they are their spiritual development. Would it not be better to be ignorant in heaven than educated in hell? My friends, we ought to think along that line. Observe how many youngsters never are trained in serious Bible study. And really, they are discouraged from even studying at all. They never see the parents study. They never see them read the Bible, nor do they see them pray. What makes us think that they're just going to happen up on that? And how frequently they neglect to worship services. They refuse to assemble with the saints when the worship is going on. And for homework, test study, whatever be the excuse, they say, well, now we just can't be in the services today. Oh, I know. It says in Matthew 6:33, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and his righteousness, and all these other things shall be added unto you. I know that Hebrews 10:25 is a direct negative command, as strong as thou shalt not kill, when he says, not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. My friends, we're in a nation that is obsessed with sports and sundry recreational activities, and they really get in the way of putting the Lord first, don't they? What are we teaching our children when we encourage and or allow them to subordinate spiritual exercises to a ball game or to a ski trip, school project? All these things are well within themselves, but none of them are to be put before the Lord, lest conviction be removed from the heart of the child. Certainly not the truth that the kingdom is to come first in one's life is there when we're doing these things, is it? And yet, that's what the Lord teaches us, and that's what we must cling to if we would expect to go to heaven at last and have the best life that we can live in this world. Pray to God, my friends, that you never have to neglect or reflect upon the disciplinary lack in your child as in the anguish of David. O Absalom, my son, resolve that you will do all within your power, rather, to inoculate your children against this heartache and against their lost and destroyed condition. It indeed is important to raise our children in the nurture and the admonition of the truth. Proverbs 22:6 still says, bring up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart therefrom.